From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last Tuesday, which marked the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment. That amendment gave most women the right to vote. I say most women because women of color would have to wait nearly five more decades before they could legally cast their ballots. But last Tuesday, President Trump marked the 19th Amendment centennial by officially pardoning suffragist Susan B. Anthony, who was arrested for voting in 1872 before she legally had the right to do so. The Susan B. Anthony Museum and House, based in Rochester, of course, was quick to respond and quick to reject the pardon. Susan B. Anthony Museum and House President Deborah Hughes said in a statement, quote, "Objection, Mr. President. Susan B. Anthony must decline your offer of a pardon," end quote. She went on to say that when Anthony was pronounced guilty, she refused to pay the penalty. Hughes explained, "To pay would have been to validate the proceedings. To pardon Susan B. Anthony does the same." Anthony died in 1906. Never saw the results of her decades of work. Neither did Matilda Jocelyn Gage, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and others who dedicated their lives to securing equal rights for women. They knew they were pursuing historic change, and their carefully documented work is a record of their passionate fight for justice. This hour, we discuss the suffragist movement and its roots in Rochester and the Finger Lakes. We also examine the state of equal rights and voting rights in the United States, a century after many women earned the right to vote. I'd like to welcome our guests now. Deborah Hughes is the president and CEO of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Wish we could see you in person, but it's nice to have you, Deborah. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Evan. Thank you.
Welcome to Walt Gabel, Seneca County historian, joining us from WEOS. Hello, Walt.
Hi, I'm glad to be a part of this.
Well, it's nice to have you, sir. Thank you. And Mary Corey is with us, Associate Professor Emerita at SUNY Brockport and author of The Political Life and Times of Matilda Jocelyn Gage. Mary, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm just going to get this out of the way because that was in the news last week, but let's do this one more time, Deborah Hughes, because, you know, across the country, people have said, well, what's the big deal? You know, it's just a pardon. It's a political pardon for an 1872 crime. Your reaction, and frankly, mirror the reaction of many people who I think have done the historical work to understand Susan B. Anthony. But why? Why reject that pardon?
You know, Evan, often we're asked, what would Susan B. Anthony think? And I try so hard not to put
words in. I know. I've done that to you so many times over the years.
Yeah, so to be frank, I was a little bit surprised how controversial this has proven to be because I didn't need to put words in her mouth. Anthony herself had assisted in the petitioning to U.S. Grant, Ulysses S. Grant, to get the three election commissioners, the three men who let the women in Rochester register and vote that day, all went to jail for having done that. And Anthony worked with her lawyers, and they submitted a petition to get Grant to pardon them. She did not submit a petition for herself. Instead, she asked for Congress to remit her fine. If Congress had remitted her fine, in effect, Congress would have been saying that her trial had been unjust and therefore the penalty of the fine was inappropriate. That's the action that she wanted. But in no way did she want to be pardoned for having been tried and convicted.
Do you think that the president's gesture in this pardon was good-natured and from a good place?
You know, it was a surprise to us. I've been approached a number of times since I've been at the Anthony Museum by staff members from a variety of political elected officials who said, hey, let's pardon Susan B. Anthony. It would be great for the museum. You could get all this PR. It would be so exciting. And I always had to say, you know, it would be inappropriate and we couldn't really support it. In this case, the White House didn't approach us and didn't ask our opinion. So I'm not going to put words into the mouth of Susan B. Anthony. I'm certainly not going to assume to know what the motivations were of the president.
Okay. Would you have told them essentially the same, that, hey, thanks for the phone call, but this is something we've routinely said would not have been in her interest?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And just so you know, the backlash for this, we have been inundated with people who are upset with the museum and with me, feeling that we insulted the president, which is certainly not our intent. And, you know, politics, as everyone knows, is business where you have to have a pretty thick skin. We're getting enough negative feedback that we actually have the voicemail going to voicemail. And our wonderful transcription service that reads the messages actually puts asterisks in every time there's an obscenity or a swear word, and we're seeing a lot of asterisks.
Well, before I turn to our other guests, I just kind of want to pursue that thread for a second here. Are those local phone calls, or is that nationally?
Nationally.
Yeah. Okay. So I suspect, Deborah, and I will say again, you know, I joked that I push Deborah to speak for Susan B. Anthony all the time, which is something Deborah is very, very respectful about saying. You know, she there are limits to what she can do to interpret what Susan B. Anthony might have thought or said. But I also know that you avoid politics, because this is not supposed to be a politically partisan organization. What you're doing is historical and community-oriented, and I've always respected that. I suspect that the president's partisans are Googling your phone number and making these calls because they view this as some sort of rejection of the president. And that happens in politics, especially in an election year. But it's too bad that you're getting deluged with obscenity. But that's this fraught, nerve jangly moment we're in right now, and I suspect it will subside soon. Have the calls subsided at all yet?
No, but it's such an interesting observation. If we step back, it's absolutely wonderful that Susan B. Anthony is still relevant in 2020, and that it can stir up such emotion and response. And of course, the reason she's relevant isn't because of Susan B. Anthony, the person. It's because of what she stood for, and I think we're still exploring that. But she passionately believed that we were not yet the union that she'd hoped for until we were really a union of the people, of all the people. And I think this is the ongoing struggle for our republic, for our democracy, which is all about voting rights. It's all about who gets to participate, and it's all about how do we figure out how to formulate great social policy that can be for the good of all. And certainly the partisan road is not the way to get there.
I certainly take the point that Susan B. Anthony is still exciting emotion and interest. I think the phone calls and the obscenities you're getting are excited more about anything that is viewed as oppositional to the president. And, you know, if the president's partisans figure out my email address and hear me say that I think his golf swing looks like an octopus falling out of a tree, to borrow a term from David Faraday, then they will probably email me the same things you're hearing. But let me ask Mary Corey, what did you make of that controversy about the pardon, and did you think that the museum and house did the right thing, Mary?
I think they did the absolute right thing, and I absolutely love Deborah's response, especially the second paragraph, about what we would have appreciated having been done, you know, celebrating the 14th, 15th, and 19th Amendments, advocacy for human rights, a strong proponent of sex education, fair labor practices, excellent public education, equal pay for equal work, and all elimination of all forms of discrimination. When I read that, I practically cheered. So I agree completely with what Deborah has said.
Do you think this moment, Mary, has at least reignited public interest in not only 100 years, but Susan B. Anthony's work, the work of the suffragists? I mean, is there an opening here to reignite the public conversation there?
I certainly hope so. I think that the centennial certainly has helped push that along. But right now we're in an era where, you know, the term voter suppression is very common, and if you look at the suffrage movement for all those years, they were essentially arguing against voter suppression. And in terms of Gage taking direct action in her own hometown to fight voter suppression when the school suffrage bill passed in New York State, and came up with some very modern, if you will, strategies, including picking women up to go to the voting places, making sure that the women knew what their rights were, and actually electing a full slate of women to the school board, including her daughter. So I think the issues are appropriate right now. It's actually kind of delightful to see it coming to the fore again in terms of women voting as well as others.
Let me ask Walt Gabel, Seneca County historian, what did you make of this controversy that started in the White House with this possible pardon?
Well, number one, I was surprised to hear the announcement that the president made. I wasn't surprised at the reaction of Lieutenant Governor Hochul, of Deborah Hughes, on behalf of the Susan B. Anthony House, and so on, to say that this is way out of line. Alice Paul, who played such a key role in helping to get the 19th Amendment ratified, in 1923, in Seneca Falls, she called for the Equal Rights Amendment for the first time to make sure that people weren't resting on their laurels, women's suffragists especially, of securing the right to vote in 1920. And so it was a very important development. Alice Paul would have felt any kind of publicity to support your cause, be it negative, be it positive, is publicity. It's free publicity. But in this case, I'm kind of afraid that, not wanting to get too political, that it might be a diversionary tactic that's been undertaken.
Well, so let me, before we kind of work our way back through history, just ask our guests to kind of reflect on the ways that sometimes progress moves in a relatively straightish line, and sometimes there are a lot of sort of starts and stops. I mean, here we are today, and listeners might have heard an hour ago, the roll call vote, the Republican National Convention has started, the vice president spoke today. President Trump has already started speaking today. He's going to speak every day at the convention, and he plans to speak during the day and during the night. So he's going to be one of the featured speaker in the afternoons and in the evenings. And one of the things that he said just 20 minutes ago, he said, quote, you can't trust this election. They're trying to steal it from the Republicans. And there is a crowd there, and they cheered him. Deborah Hughes, when we talk about stealing elections or not trusting elections, again, this is not meant to be partisan, but I do hope that the president's supporters understand that's not really based on anything. I mean, there is no reason to think that the United States voting system right now is designed to be fully rigged and just to support. Because if the president wins, he's not going to make that claim. He did not make that claim in 2016. I find it dangerous to tell, you know, millions of your supporters, by the way, this whole thing, they're trying to steal it from you. Don't trust it. What do you make of that, Deborah Hughes?
Well, voter suppression, which of course started when the nation started, is a partisan strategy, and that's its danger. If you're in the group that has the power, you want to suppress the other people, but that's not what a republic is all about. So working against voter suppression should be a part of we the people. We all should be deeply concerned that until we really do have, until we do away with all forms of voter suppression, it actually, when I was thinking about Susan B. Anthony voter suppression, I was not thinking of the current Postal Service. I could spend hours talking about various forms of voter suppression. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 was to assure that the 15th and the 19th and the 14th Amendments were actually followed, because voter suppression, we have a huge history of that. And I think it should absolutely not be a partisan issue if we talk about how are we going to have fair representation, how are we going to have fair elections. The problem is that there are people who do benefit from it and who benefits changes from election cycle to election cycle. But to me, this is the we the people. We ought to speak more clearly than any political party.
Mary Corey, are you concerned that in 2020, all of this talk about rigging or illegitimate elections is going to hurt this process, hurt outcomes, or hurt trust in institutions?
I certainly think that it has every chance to do exactly that. But, as Deborah has mentioned, over the years, we've always had this kind of thing happening. If you go back to poll taxes and grandfather clauses and literacy tests, all of the Jim Crow array to keep people of color from exercising their right to vote. So it's not new, but it's always disturbing.
Mm. Walt Gabel, what do you think?
Well, way back in the July 1848 convention in Seneca Falls, the Declaration of Sentiments, in effect, was articulating the concept for women of no taxation without representation. Mm-hmm. The right to vote, the right to hold elected office, all of these things are very important. Sadly, we're still today struggling with that. I want to think that all of the recent verbiage about voter suppression and maybe covert actions to that effect, I want to be hopeful and say that this may very well prompt even a bigger voter turnout, because more and more potential voters will be concerted in their desire to actually vote, whether it's in-person voting or rather it's by mail.
Now, at 1:07 p.m., the president said today that Democrats are going to go door-to-door to steal this election. I don't really know what that means, but he also said that he wishes there were more dams in this country, but environmentalists won't allow it. I have no idea what he's talking about today. Let's move on from that, and let's get back to where we would have been here. You know, because in many ways, Deborah Hughes, this was supposed to be a very different year. 2020, before the pandemic, not to say that you can't celebrate and you can't honor and mark history, but boy, I know there were big plans here. How much has changed with this pandemic?
Well, all kinds of things changed. So many celebrations aren't happening. I actually have the Rose, the 1917 Model T car that was supposed to be going across the Finger Lakes with lots of our collaborative partners. Is sitting in our driveway right now. He hasn't been out as much as we thought because we haven't been able to have those public events and large gatherings. I have to say, though, 2020 has proved to be an historic year. There's no doubt about that. And in terms of things that Susan B. Anthony was passionate about, we are having the right kinds of discussions right now. There's a great deal at stake, and there's a great deal of progress that can be made. And so in the ways that the museum is so committed to working for the human rights issues that were important to Susan B. Anthony, the year has had more opportunities.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just want to make sure that you've got as much time as you like to lay out exactly how you are able to, despite everything going on, honor the 19th Amendment centennial.
Well, the amazing thing is how many virtual events have come onto the table. In most cases, we're not getting a lot of advance notice about it. You know, Seneca Falls just had a whole virtual weekend last weekend. There are things I could be doing great things all day right now, and we're learning, from things like the skydivers who landed over the new monument in Tennessee, celebrating Tennessee being the perfect state that ratified, to the sculpture that's going to be dedicated on the 26th in Central Park, to lectures and events and conversations that are happening all over the place. There's a lot more going on than we thought, but it is a little bit hard to keep up with it on a virtual level. The other is, because we're doing things virtually, we've eliminated geographic barriers that had been a problem. Having conversations from California to New York to Canada to Florida, it's exciting the ways that people are able to participate. We are still having our Suffragist City Parade on September 12th, but we decided about 10 days ago that it will be all virtual. One of the people who's going to be appearing in our Suffragist City Parade is Mimi Ang, who is the engineer from NASA who designed the helicopter that's on its way to Mars. So we could not have possibly had Mimi participate walking down West Main Street, but we're thrilled she can be a part of the celebration now.
And how can people get in touch and follow along with you? What's the best way to do that?
Well, if they want to know about the Suffragist City Parade, they can go to our website, and under events, they can click on the parade, and it tells them how to participate if they want to send us, we're calling them virtual floats, and if they want to watch. But at 10:30 on Saturday, September 12th, we will be broadcasting the parade, and it will be online, and we'll have more details about that. And we'd love to have as many people participate and watch as we can.
Walt Gabel, Why don't you tell us, as you see a very different 2020, maybe from your perspective, have we lost a big opportunity this year, given the pandemic, to really get people reconnected, or are you seeing things happen?
Well, we did, to a great extent, lose an opportunity. The Women's Rights National Historical Park had been planning a whole series of events for convention days in mid-July of this year, and of course, physically that didn't take place, but there were virtual things as well as this past weekend. However, on Wednesday of this week, which is Women's Equality Day, the National Women's Hall of Fame is going to have the, in effect, grand opening of the first floor of the new facility to which they have moved, the Center for Great Women. However, that has to be done on an appointment basis so that they can maintain the numbers and social distancing restrictions that need to take place.
All right. That's from the Seneca County historian. Mary Corey, as the author of The Political Life and Times of Matilda Jocelyn Gage and Associate Professor Emerita at SUNY Brockport, do you see 2020 as maybe missed opportunities, or you think there's enough momentum now to keep the public appetite for the history here and for sort of the education that people need to understand everything that happened here?
Well, I think it's really forced people to get very creative, and we can't underestimate the role of social networking on things like Facebook and Liker, where people are coming together. A very new group just formed, Suburban Women for Kamala, and it has close to 100,000 members already. How suburban women will vote for me, and suburban women are saying, no, we won't. So you're seeing an awful lot of creative ways to do things. I've been preparing to teach a class online that would have normally been held at NYU, and it's the Center for Living and Learning, and we're going to do 100 Years of Woman Suffrage in October. So things have gone to virtual, but that hasn't actually been a detriment in many ways.
Well, and here's Gary asking, who is Matilda Jocelyn Gage? Well, her story isn't as well known as Susan B. Anthony's, so why don't you tell listeners like him what you think they ought to know about Matilda Jocelyn Gage?
Okay, well, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, and actually thanks to Sally Reitner at the Gage Foundation over in Fayetteville, is not quite so obscure as she used to be, let's say, 20 years ago, even 10 years and 5 years ago. But she was one of these three top women in the National Woman Suffrage Association. Anthony and Stanton and Gage together put together the first three volumes of the history of woman suffrage. And over the years, and I'm glad Walt mentioned the 1923 gathering in Seneca Falls, because interestingly enough, by 1923, Stanton had nearly been lost to us at that time. And that's a long story I won't go into. But Gage was one of the primary writers for the women's history of women's suffrage, as was Stanton, whereas Anthony took care of myriad administrative tasks, finding a publisher, making sure that, and as a go-between between all of the women of the various states. So, but Gage and Anthony had a falling out, and unfortunately for Gage, the story of her work was told through Anthony after that falling out, and her role was diminished. But the interesting part about Gage is that when I was researching her, I actually started out wondering if I was going to find anything. And my thesis advisor at the U of R, Mary Young, said, get into the correspondence. Well, that just opened up this continent of information, whereas if you looked at their secondary sources, the three volumes that were put together by Harper and Anthony, you wouldn't find much about Gage. But if you go into the correspondence, they were completely in touch constantly and very much together. to the point where Gage was the person who wrote Anthony's speech when they canvassed on a, which county was it? The one south of when her trial was moved to Canandaigua. Was that Ontario County? And was there throughout the trial to support her. So she was very, very important to the suffrage movement and is finally coming into her own. People are interested to know about her. She was sort of a rebel, too. She, you know, she wasn't an easy person to get along with in many ways.
Well, Mary's the author of The Political Life and Times of Matilda Jocelyn Gage. When you're talking about correspondence that has survived, one thing I'm confident of is, you know, Mary, nobody's going to be looking up my text messages 100 years in the future. No, but I am so glad that we have this medium that survives in so many ways. What was it like going through the correspondence?
Well, the first thing I want to say about going through the correspondence is that these women were writers, but their writing was just horrible. Their handwriting, I literally...
You mean their penmanship?
Their penmanship. Their penmanship
their pen womanship was terrible.
It was terrible. One day I was going through, it was all when I was doing this, it was all on reels of microfilm, going one, you know, one slide at a time. And I finally found a letter from Helen Leslie to her mother. And she was actually complaining about the poor penmanship among the people in the family. And I said, you are not kidding. But it was time-consuming, but it was just enthralling, absolutely enthralling. They wrote about everything, and And the interesting thing is, I found most of the stuff about Gage in the Stanton and Anthony papers, as well as Gage's National Citizen and Ballot Box, which is also it's been digitalized now, but at the time I was looking at it, it was all on microfilm. So. It's a fascinating story, but you do get cross-eyed after about 23 reels of it.
Well, so Deborah Hughes, can you confirm that the penmanship is its own course of study?
Back in another lifetime, I studied Hebrew and Greek in the scriptures, and Anthony and Gage at times can be as difficult to translate, particularly at the end of the day. You know, they're writing after hours. And they're scribbling at the end of the day, and we have had long discussions where what the writer intends hinges upon us transcribing two or three words in a sentence. So yes, absolutely. I have to say, Gage, I didn't meet Gage until I came to the Anthony Museum, and it was through Sally Rush Wagner. And Gage doesn't get credit. She was one of the earliest feminist theologians. So much of what I studied when I was in seminary, you would have thought these were brand new ideas in the 1970s and the 1980s. But then when I started to read Gage, I discovered, oh, no, she said this long before anyone else began to work with it. And she was way ahead of her time in terms of her thinking and her arguments. But, yes, her handwriting and also her punctuation, which is missing, reminds me of the original Greek.
Can I insert just one thing?
Yes, please.
From what Deborah said, one of the more fascinating things that came out of the suffrage movement was Gage's monograph, which I have looked high and low. I haven't found anything like it. I think hers is the only monograph that came out of the suffrage movement. It's called Woman, Church, and State. And that's where one chapter of the first volume of the History of Woman Suffrage ended with her chapter, Woman, Church, and State, which she then expanded later after her falling out and leaving NASA. But recently, her work has been being studied much more carefully, and a history professor emeritus, Sue Stewart, said that she was really a pioneer in the world history movement, and said that she left her readers dismayed by her conclusions should not blind us to the excellence of her work as a historian. And I think that that particular volume should get much more attention than it has in the past, although it is getting some attention. She's just wonderful.
And, you know, Mary, you also, I think, seem to want to remind readers that as much as we think about Susan B. Anthony, when we think about Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, we may view them in the context of a movement, and they become less of a person and more of like a cog in a movement machine. But you write that as you were researching, you were struck by how closely their yearly cycles of movement work were similar to your own teaching and writing yearly cycles, and even how familiar it was to hear them talk about weddings, family illnesses, kids, the drudgeries. I mean, it humanized just how much work and how many years of work we're talking about, intermixed with just, you know, a life lived that has some similarities to people today. Fair?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, right to the idea that, yes, they had the convention in 1848, but the real work of suffrage for women specifically didn't start until after the Civil War. They had thrown themselves, all of them, American Equal Rights Association, which contained Lucy Stone and Henry Blackwell and Antoinette Blackwell and the others, they all threw themselves into the Civil War movement. So it wasn't until afterwards, and by that time, many of the women who were doing this work were in their 40s, and their children were somewhat grown up at that point. In fact, that's one of the reasons why Gage was able to travel and speak as much as she did, because she had two adult daughters who could take care of her youngest at home, which was very similar to a lot of people I met when I was in graduate school. Many of their scholarly work had been put on a back burner until their kids were of an age where they could be left a bit. So they were in their 40s at this point, and you know, family events were very much a part of it. They all took time off to mourn lost leaders. They had their own. Anthony lost, two of her sisters during this time. Gage lost her husband. They were busy women, just like we are today.
Deborah Hughes, you know, when I think about Susan B. Anthony and how often she becomes this mythic figure, I think at least the correspondence, to the extent that we can make out what she was saying, these are the moments where we see that these are human beings. These were human beings who had their own struggles, had their own disagreements, even with close associates and friends, disagreements about where the movement should go or the urgencies of this and that. And then, you know, simply had to deal with life as largely as we might know it. And I think that reminds us that as difficult as life can be, in, you know, when times are feel rough, and if they feel fraught and frayed lately, that these were not superhumans. I mean, as much as Susan B. Anthony was, I mean, but she was just a person, and I think that matters today. Do you agree, Deborah?
I do. I also think, I was thinking about, you know, with Walter, and thinking about Sally Rush Wagner and the Gage House, 10 years ago when we had our coalition, including the Women's Hall of Fame and the Women's Rights Park, and we were all getting together to say, boy, by the time we get to 2020, what can we do together? And our assumption was that no one was really very interested in suffrage history. We would have to do some street theater. That's why we did Votilla and Floated on the Canal, and why we were going to get this Model T out there. It was to draw attention to this. I think now it's shifted for me. I don't agree with the people who say, well, we already know all about Susan B. Anthony. Yeah, that's silly. Most people don't know much at all about Susan B. Anthony, and we're still learning so much about women's history. But if Anthony can be an entry point, whether you like her or dislike her, mm-hmm. to learning about the conflicts and the people, the individuals and the organizing and the very real application to today politics, then we totally welcome that. Let her be the lightning rod to a whole storm of energy around learning about women's history, learning about our local history, our regional history. But then, more importantly, you know, Anthony herself was interested in the present and the future. So okay. If she can be an entry point to a better society, then we're excited.
Yeah, let me bring in Walt. Go ahead, Walt.
What I think we've been hearing in these past few minutes is an excellent dialogue to emphasize that we're talking about a humongous and important movement, but it was really being spearheaded by individuals, and they weren't all on the same page in terms of their specific beliefs, but they were also very much human beings that had day-to-day lives and so on that they had to deal with. And I think an aspect of history that doesn't get emphasized enough is the human history of what's happening day to day to see the larger picture in that context.
Talking to Walt Gabel, Seneca County historian, who's joining us from WEOS. Deborah Hughes, president and CEO of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Mary Corey is with us, an associate professor emerita at SUNY Brockport and author of The Political Life and Times of Matilda Jocelyn Gage. We're talking about Susan B. Anthony and Gage and Stanton and the women, especially, who led this movement that led up to what became the 19th Amendment, the centennial, happening now in a very, very different kind of year. 2020 was going to be a year of celebration and history and commemoration. Very different now, but we want to make sure you're caught up to date on what still is happening and how to be involved with that. And WXXI has a virtual event on Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m. Paul Barnes is the co-director and co-producer of the Ken Burns miniseries Not For Ourselves Alone, the story of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. And 7 to 9, they'll show clips from the groundbreaking documentary. Barnes will share stories from the creation of the documentary, and special guest Allie McGraw will be reading excerpts from the book The Women's Hour by Elaine Weiss. The event is part of WXXI's Celebrate 2020 initiative, and you can find programs, local audio, video vignettes, on-demand programming, and more at the Celebrate 2020 website. So check it out there, and please join us on WXXI TV Wednesday, 7 to 9 p.m. We're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, SUNY school leaders join us to talk about colleges reopening this fall, plans for students, dealing with infections, and expectations for student behavior. That's in our first hour. In our second hour, we're talking about something called compassion fatigue. If you feel so burned out that it's hard to show sympathy or empathy, we're going to talk about what that means and how to deal with it. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back. Talking about Susan B. Anthony, 100 years. And I guess I just want to ask Deborah Hughes what you think, if we haven't spent enough time on that subject this year, given everything with the pandemic, what we're missing and what opportunities you might feel that we're missing and what we can do about that, Deborah.
Well, I think, Susan B. Anthony is a great entry point into what we're discussing around the intersectionality of race and gender, and certainly that's a topical piece. When we look at Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass, it's a little frustrating to me when people suggest that they disagreed, that one wanted, that Douglass wanted black men and Susan B. Anthony wanted white women to get the vote. I think that's a misrepresentation of both of them. I believe they both wanted everyone to get the vote, and what they disagreed on with the 15th Amendment was the strategy of should you get what you can get now and hold off until you can get the whole loaf later? We still do need to address this question about voting rights in this country. And I think that's really significant and really important. I also think, how do we as a country exist in this world where we have political parties and partisanship and continue to encourage those people that we elect, those people that we send to government, who represent us, despite that? In my opinion, if you're a candidate, you have a political party, but once you're elected, you should represent everybody in your district or your state or your country. I think Anthony would like for us to move to a place where we understood good government from that angle.
Yeah, let me just follow up with you there before I turn to your co-panelists on that subject here. I was going to ask you a version of what Susan B. Anthony would think. I'm trying to rephrase this so I don't do that to you, Deborah. I guess I'll ask you what you think instead of asking what Susan B. might have thought. We still see a much lower number in terms of per capita representation of women in government, whether it's the United States Senate, Congress, governorships, etc. I mean, that's certainly changing, but we still see an underrepresentation. Is it a case where you think that there ought to be, and I don't mean a forced 50-50, 51-49, whatever the split is in the population. I don't mean that, but I guess I'm asking how important it is to you that we still see that disparity.
Oh, I think that when our elected bodies begin to actually reflect what the constituency, what the people of the United States look like on every level, we will see a much more effective government. And I think that one of the reasons that we don't have that yet is that there are, people have benefited from keeping their power. You know, once you get 20 people around the table who bring all kinds of different perspectives, whether it's class, race, gender, opportunity, national background, religion, then you can start to have conversations. You have to compromise. And different people will be talking about, well, that's a great policy, but here's how it impacts me. We have to get beyond, my team says we do A and your team says we do B. That's not serving the American people.
Mary Corey, do you agree with that?
I do indeed, of course. I was just thinking as you asked the question, I'm reminded of a comment that Ruth Bader Ginsburg made when she was asked how many would be enough women on the Supreme Court, and she said 9. So I think, you know, we're moving along in a direction that is beginning to acknowledge the disparities, and I think we're moving in that direction. If you look at what America looks like, our Congress and our Senate and our all of our elected officials should be reflecting that, because each brings to the table an important perspective. And when you go ahead willy-nilly without taking it into consideration, that's when you run into conflict.
All right. Can I ask Walt Gabel to weigh in that as well? Go ahead, Walt.
Well, I have a couple of comments that draw largely upon my high school teaching. I taught high school social studies in Seneca Falls for 30 years, the last 30 years of my teaching. And the last 10 years of that, I was the department chair, and I would get contacted by a newspaper reporter from out of the immediate area, as in February typically, and would say, what are the Seneca Falls social studies teachers going to do for Women's History Month? And the words that would pop right out of my mouth first were very simple. Every month is Women's History Month. We don't need the tokenism of thinking of it just in terms of March. And I think we have come a long ways towards that, but we've still got a long ways to go. The other factor I used to tell my U.S. history and government classes, when we've had 9 female justices on the Supreme Court for several years, then maybe it might be time to think again about appointing a male to the Supreme Court. Maybe the same kind of perspective for the U.S. presidency, but of course I won't live to see that happen. But we need to keep in mind that we've come a long ways, but there is still so much yet to accomplish. And from my perspective, the sooner the better.
All right. Let me get a phone call from Carrie on the phone next. Go ahead, Carrie.
Hi there. My name is Carrie. I'm a representative for the Susan B. Anthony Birthplace Museum, where we have a cycler named Nick Crossett. He's cycling for suffrage over the next few days. So today he's going to the Matilda Jocelyn Gage House in Fayetteville, New York, and tomorrow he'll be cycling from there to Seneca Falls. But he kicked off at the Susan B. Anthony Birthplace Museum, and his entire 334-mile trek is for suffrage, is commemorating the suffrage. So he's already raised a ton of money, and he's gonna finish off in Rochester. And I just wanted to put that out there that he will be that he's doing that. So that's his way of commemorating the month, and as well as. Susan B. Anthony herself at our museum. So, yeah, thank you.
Carrie, thank you for the phone call. I appreciate that. And as we said, it's not that there's nothing going on. There are some events going on. Deborah Hughes, everybody misses things like the flotilla, or the votilla. I said flotilla. The votilla.
Go
ahead, Deborah.
We will do all of Votercade 2020 in 2021. So we'll be going to Ganondagan and the public market, and we'll be going to Geneva, and we'll be going to Auburn, all of our partners. So there's an opportunity to keep celebrating another century of voting rights.
And can I also just ask you, just to kind of follow up on a point that you were starting to make, Deborah, about Susan B. Anthony and, sort of how you divide your efforts or focus on, who gets the vote first. as you know, there's been a lot of debate, especially in social media circles, about whether Susan B. Anthony, you know, whether her role or her place has diminished at all, given, you know, given suffrage for women of color and who was included in movements and who was not. Are we moving? I don't want to dismiss those concerns because I understand them and I think they're very real and legitimate. But do you think we're moving to a point where there's understanding of where Susan B. Anthony was on those issues? You know, even if people don't always agree on how to sort of venerate her role in some of this, or do you think there's still some animosity about this?
There's definitely some animosity. And some of what people have picked up on soundbites is flat out wrong. We've chosen not to engage in that debate because it's kind of silly to try to have any kind of educational debate on social media. We've got lots of years to set the record about Susan B. Anthony, and we expect at the Anthony Museum we're going to learn some things we didn't know, and we expect there'll be some things that will be hard to hear, but that's part of what we really want to do. I think Anthony would... Deborah Hughes believes that Susan B. Anthony would want us to use these conversations to learn how to be anti-racist, to learn how to be a better society. So I think that's the question about, can we take whatever the conversation, if it needs to be an honest conversation, you know, some of the great questions that come, how does a museum decide about who you take money from? Mm-hmm. Have we checked out the politics of the people who make contributions to us? How do I have voted for candidates based on one or two issues and not known how they felt about other things. Mm-hmm. Well, let's be awake to that. And a whole lot of people still don't understand that both the 15th and the 19th Amendments had a responsibility for Congress to pass laws to make sure that we didn't violate those new voting rights. And the Voting Rights Act of 1965, it took till 1965 for Congress to say, we're going to protect the laws for Black men that was established way back in the 1860s, because Jim Crow, all of the anti-voting laws were against the 15th Amendment, but Congress that had the responsibility to act didn't act until 1965. Mm-hmm. I think we've got a lot to learn still.
Let me read one more email, and I'll ask all of our guests to comment, maybe about a minute apiece. Brett says, Evan, I take your guest's point, and it would be great to have 50% women in Congress, but we don't necessarily need 50% women in Congress. We do need men who will be true allies to women's causes. That's from Brett. Deborah Hughes, do you agree with that?
I certainly agree that I cannot use someone's gender to determine if I like what their politics.
Okay, fair enough. Taken to its logical conclusion, Brett's point, and I don't mean to belittle it. I mean, I'm listening to what he says. Could we have a Congress that was 100% male, but cared and was in tune enough with women's issues and concerns to represent them fairly, Deborah?
If we had a 100% male Congress who passed the Equal Rights Amendment and assured that we had child care for all, then I would say absolutely.
Okay. All right, Mary, what do you think?
That's a tough one to field. I think, as the women would say, and actually I think it was Anthony who said it, that men can never advocate on behalf of women as effectively as women can, and she was using that when she was criticizing the membership and the leadership of the American Woman Suffrage Association. So I'll just leave it at her words.
Okay, Walt?
Well, I would remind our listening audience that it was a predominantly male Congress that did propose the 19th Amendment. And for many of the states, when it came time to ratify that 19th Amendment, many of the states had not already granted women in that state the right to vote, and so it was once again clearly largely male voters that male elected representatives of the state legislature that were ratifying this proposed amendment. But I agree very much, as a man, I have pointed out many times when I've gotten asked to speak about the women's rights movement and so on, do you think a man's perspective can really be adequate for talking about a women's rights issue? You can be historically accurate, but I do think there is a very definite value in having people of their own kind represent and speak on issues of their own kind.
Walt Gable is the Seneca County historian who's been joining us from WEOS. I want to thank you again for the time. You've been generous with it, Walt. Thanks for being with us and for sharing your perspective this hour.
Thank you.
Mary Corey is the author of The Political Life and Times of Matilda Jocelyn Gage, which would be a lovely read in 2020 or any year, and the book's available. Mary, thank you for making the time for the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful.
Deborah Hughes, President and CEO of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. One more time, let people know how they can get engaged with everything that you have going on.
They can go to our website, susanb.org, and check events, see what's happening. And they can also follow us along in Facebook, where there's a lot of activity.
Facebook page for the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. And I'll just say there's a lot with Susan B. Anthony's name on it. Make sure it's the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Because there's, you know, you never know who's appropriating the names. Deborah, always good. And I know we'll see you in person at some point. But thanks for making time for us this hour, and let's talk soon.
And we look forward to Wednesday night. Thanks, Evan.
Wonderful. Yeah, Wednesday night, 7 to 9 on WXXI-TV. Paul Barnes, co-director and co-producer of the Ken Burns miniseries Not For Ourselves Alone, shares clips from the story of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. That's Wednesday night. Rob Braden is the engineer of Connections. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.